heaven with Isaiah's prayer, the prophet Isaiah, for God to open the heavens and come down. And so in our worship services this season, we've been reflecting on what it might mean for the God who opens the heavens to open our hearts. And today, reflecting with one of the great promises of Isaiah, what it might mean to open our hearts to God's promise of peace. Second chapter, prophet Isaiah. In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and he shall be raised above the hills. All nations shall stream to it. Many people shall come and say, "Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths." For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. The timeless words of the prophet Isaiah, words that describe his dream of a world where all people will be restored to life and hope and peace, regardless of name, color, religion, or heritage. Someday, he says, someday, the people will stream toward the wonderful mountain of God, and God's word of justice and peace will go forth and prevail. Peace. Person will travel with person, nation with nation, and all will find peace. On that day, people of the earth will mold the sword into the plowshare and the spear into the pruning hook, and our grim fascination with war and violence will be no more. Wonderful words. Words we hear every Advent and Christmas. But can we really imagine such a world? Can we really imagine the blade of the sword transformed into the blade of the plow? A blade used for cutting into the surface of the earth so that new seed can be planted? Can we imagine that seed bringing forth life and hope to an aching world? Can we imagine putting away our own angry and hurtful thoughts that cut and slice, and in their stead planting seeds of reconciliation, tolerance, understanding? What might it take for us not to learn war anymore? A colleague shares a story about a year of study he spent in Germany with his family back in the early 60s. He'd been at a meeting in Zurich and was now on a train to rejoin his family in Germany. Anxious to get home, he stopped in the Zurich station just long enough to grab a sandwich before getting on the train. His command of German was iffy at best, so he always tried to find a train compartment with a lot of people in it so he wouldn't have to say much. But this train was quite full. He ended up in a back compartment with an elderly woman. He says, "I figured if I went in there, there'd be two of us, which means I'd have 50% of the conversation. Could I handle it?" Well, I had no choice. As I sat down, I said, "Nice day." But she just nodded and stared out the window. I decided to try another German sentence. "Are you going home?" Again, she turned and just nodded. "Wow," I thought, "I know more German than she does." I grew more bold. "I'm going to Stuttgart." "Where are you going?" "Rostock," she said. Rostock. That was a city in East Germany, communist Germany. She told me she'd been able to get travel papers so that she could visit her grandchildren for a month. I asked, "Are you a communist?" "No," she answered, "I'm a Christian." I said, "I'm a Christian, and I'm from America." "Oh, yes, I know," she said. We began to talk. "What's it like to be a Christian in East Germany?" "Well, what's it like to be a Christian in America?" She had a music box. She wound it up, and it began to play Silent Night. She sang a verse. She invited me to sing along, which I did as best I could. I had that sandwich. My stomach was starting to growl. I was hungry. But I didn't want to eat my sandwich in front of her. Finally, I thought, well, at least I could share it. But then I ran into another problem. It was a German sandwich. The bread was extremely hard. I couldn't get the thing in two. Kept banging it over my knee, trying to break it in half. Finally, it broke, and I was able to share. Now, I hadn't noticed, but in the meantime, she had peeled an orange and was extending half of it to me. Half a sandwich, half an orange. We talked of being Christians in America and East Germany. When we got to Stuttgart, she said, "Well, God go with you, and God go with you," I said. And I could have sworn that we shared communion on that train. I've often thought about her. I wonder if she's ever thought of me. One half sandwich and one half orange, that's the Christian way. I now live in Tennessee. Sometimes I think, how far is it from Tennessee to Rostock, Germany? You know how far it is? I checked the map. It's about as far as the distance across a train compartment table. That's how far it is. I believe this is a story about peace and peacemaking. And I realize it may not sound like much in a world of such monstrous evil these days as what's going on in the Islamic State, terrorists in Nigeria who kidnap and enslave young girls, or those who slaughter children in Pakistan. It may not sound like much in our own country, where once again we debate difficult issues of race and equal justice under the law, and confront our own prejudices or even our own addiction to violence. A year since the murders at Newtown, has anything changed? We seem so much more efficient at beating plowshares into swords. And yet, even in my most disappointed and cynical moments, I am not ready to walk away from the vision of Isaiah of a world at peace. It's an old story and a true one. A California couple had grown weary of their house. They decided to sell it and find another. They put it in the hands of a real estate agent, and as they began searching for a new home they might like, they started reading ads themselves in the paper just to see what might be available out there. They stumbled upon an ad for a house that just seemed perfect for them. They eagerly called the listed phone number, and to their great astonishment discovered, yeah, they're inquiring about their own house. Not hard to picture that family. Tired of leaky faucets, too much lawn, an old roof, perhaps unruly neighbors. They wanted a new home, a new location, an escape from the old pressures and problems. And it's tempting. Who can blame them? It's tempting to want to just get away from all this and start over. How can there be any hope for peace in times like these? And yet, the fact of the matter is there is no new house to which we can move, no flawless neighborhood just around the corner, no place to which we can flee and get away from it all. I mean, I keep praying, beam me up, Scotty, but it just ain't going to happen. And Isaiah knows this. Never forget, he writes to a people who know war and rumors of war all too well. And yet it is right there in the midst of this people, in the midst of danger and conflict and violence, that he shares his timeless vision of peace. It is precisely in times like these that we are called to do the things that make for peace. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark streets shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. Look at where the action of Christmas is focused. Not on some idyllic Christmas card tableau, but in the dirty, everyday streets of Bethlehem or any city. Any place, anywhere where hopes and dreams compete for territory. Any place where women and men struggle to decide which way shall I lean, toward my hopes or toward my fears. Where does peacemaking begin? You know. Where does change begin? You know. Where does hope begin? Right here, right now, with each of us. There's so much I cannot do, and there's so much I cannot change. But does that mean I'm powerless to do anything? Rosemary Lynch and Elaine Richard have done a lot of work over the years on teaching people skills of what they call nonviolent spiritual practices. Skills that could be opening and transforming for people. Here's some of what they teach. I've asked my good friend Andy here to put these on the screen. Learn to recognize and respect the sacred in every person, including ourselves, and every part of creation. Number two, recognize deeply who I am, with all gifts and richness, and with all limitations, failings, and weaknesses. Three, recognize that what I resent in another often comes from my difficulty in admitting that the same reality lives also in me. Four, give up the we-they game. It divides us into good and bad and allows us to demonize the adversary. Five, see ourselves as part of the creation, remembering that the destruction of our planet is a spiritual problem and not simply a scientific one. And finally, slow down and be patient. Plant the seeds of love and forgiveness. Slowly, we will grow in love, compassion, and the capacity to forgive. You see, the biblical concept of peace is not limited to the absence of war, though our popular concept of peace has frequently been confined to this narrow definition. Rather, it's shalom, the Hebrew word for peace. And it's much deeper in meaning. Shalom refers to the concern for blessedness, wholeness, prosperity, safety, welfare, happiness, and security for all God's people. It is not private, but collective. Social and public. It is all about community and what it takes to build community. Not at all otherworldly, but very much concerned with what we are doing here and now in this world to nurture and to build shalom. Which brings me back to that train story. No, I suppose I cannot single-handedly bring peace to the Middle East or even to the mean streets of American cities. But I can reach across the table, share half a sandwich, break through prejudice and fear, and see not a stereotype, but a person, a beloved child of God, looking right back at me. We long for transformation. and wish it would happen magically before our eyes. But it will not happen without serious thought, effort, sacrifice, conversation, and commitment on our part. Swords don't just magically melt into plowshares. We must hope for it to happen, pray for it to happen, long for it, and work for it. Yes, Isaiah's vision of peace is not a spectator sport. A colleague tells of walking the dusty streets of an Arab village, meeting a young boy playing a flute. He asked to see the flute from which came such lovely music because it seemed so awkward. On examining it, he found that the flute was fashioned from an old gun barrel. Now that's beating swords into plowshares. But it makes a deeper point. For there is something each of us can take from our lives and fashion into an instrument through which we can make beautiful music until the deeper harmonies of life are restored and we discover peace within ourselves, within our world, between ourselves and others, and with God. For closing prayer, these words from a great saint of the church, Howard Thurman. When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flock, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among all, to make music in the heart. Amen.